dear people, you have found your way to For Real, and I'm your grateful host, Kim Stewart. Today, we get the chance to hear from a pastry chef. I want you to enjoy the idea of that right now, because every day should include some wisdom from a pastry chef. Kendall Vanderslice is a baker, a writer, the owner of a beagle named Strudel. I mean, come on. And she is the author of a new book, By Bread Alone, A Baker's Reflections on Hunger, Longing, and the Goodness of God. I so enjoyed hearing from Kendall, both in her lovely book and in this conversation. So without another second of waiting, here is the woman who has a lot to teach us about the beauty of community and a shared loaf of deliciousness, Kendall Vanderslice. Kendall Vanderslice, I'm so excited, first about your last name, and second that you have joined me on For Real. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited you're here. You are a baker, and your last name says to you the destiny that God crafted in your very life. I'm sure everyone does a little wink when they hear
they
that your last name.
They do, but I love it. You know what? I have people who like truly don't believe that it's my given name.
Hilarious.
They think that I must have made it up.
Well, but it's not. Real it's perfect. Oh my gosh, it's just the best. I love it. I'm Dutch. That sounds a little Dutch. Is Vanderslice Dutch?
It is, although I have one family member who has traced back as far as they can.
Yeah.
And it was like 17th century or something.
Okay.
When the Vanderslices came over. So it has been deeply Americanized.
Yeah.
We have no sense of connection.
We probably didn't say Vanderslice in the 1700s. It was like Vanderslice
or something. Yeah.
Sure. We'll go with that.
Yes.
Well, I'm so excited to chat with you today. I was telling you before we started recording that I feel like I've been hanging out with you and that we're already friends, because I've been spending glorious time in your brand new book. It's called By Bread Alone, A Baker's Reflections on Hunger, Longing, and the Goodness of God. And it's such a beautiful book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Here's my secret. This is like a wonderful, heart-filling project for me to have this podcast. And so I am very excited to hand select all of our guests, because we don't have super long seasons. It's about 20 episodes per season. So I get to get real choosy. And so when your publicist contacted me, typically when publicists contact me, I have the side eye because I think, well, maybe, but she sent me the PDF of your book, which was a really good idea, because I started reading and had to email and said, if she is available, I would love to have a conversation with her. So kudos to you, because that means you wrote such a beautiful, even first chapter that I was in, hook, line, and sinker.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well done. I'd love to just dive right in. I have a whole bunch of questions for you. In fact, this interview was really hard for me to prep because I had lists and lists of questions, and I don't think anyone listens to an 8-hour podcast. And so, so we're not going to do that to you or to our listeners, but you are classically trained as a pastry chef. You are battle tested in the wearying, cutthroat world of fine restaurants. You are an earner of 2 master's degrees. I believe you are a James Beard Award winner. Correct.
National scholar. So a scholarship winner, not quite the same as the big awards, but yes.
Tomato, tomato. That means you won. And you are perpetually curious about this intersection of faith and food. What a fascinating road you have already walked at your young, tender age. Here's my very first question. What would 16-year-old Kendall make of the life that you have built? Did she see all of this coming?
No. I think she would be shocked. 16-year-old Kendall could not have even imagined going to college, let alone continuing in school for so long.
How about that?
So I think she would have been shocked about that. But really, when I was 16, I thought if I was going to go to school, I was going to go study nutrition, work with dancers who have eating disorders. That was really kind of what I envisioned. So I think that desire to work in food, care about, you know, bodies in some way was a kernel of an idea there. But I never could have envisioned this.
You write so compellingly about some of your growing up and your life as a dancer, and then your life on Mercy Ships. This, you kind of pull this thread throughout this book, with both food imagery and literal feasting in the Bible as a compatriot to all of those things. You kind of weave back and forth into that. And I'm wondering, why the Zoom focus on bread? Why not, like, you know, olive oil or pomegranates or wine?
Yeah.
Was bread always the tug?
Bread. So baking in general was always something that I loved. I think I really got into bread in college. I was just fascinated by the fact that this was a living thing. The fact that there's like the sense of your lack of control, but also this need to understand and create the right environment. I think there was just something very sort of humbling in the process of getting to know bread. But then as I dug deeper into bread specifically, just realizing the imagery, all of, like, you know, bread itself, all the chemistry behind it, I there's just so much beauty there and so much to probe and explore. But I also think when I look at kind of food, the function of food in scripture, bread both, I think, functions as bread. There's something specific to bread, but then bread also serves as this window into so many other things. The ways that God provides for us in community, in kind of our regular provision of needs, bread serves as kind of a window into all different kinds of meals and food. And so I love studying both bread as a particular thing and bread as a larger kind of object that is a metaphor for so much else.
It's everywhere in scripture. I mean, now that I have that, it's like, you know, when you see those things when you're little, yeah. You look at the monkey in the tree. Now you can't not see the monkey.
Yes.
Already reading this morning, I was like, it's everywhere. Everywhere I look, there's bread in both Testaments.
Yes. And I think it's just such a basic thing, such a mundane thing that we don't even notice it because we're so used to, like, the language of bread is woven into our, like, vernacular all the time. We talk about daily bread. We talk about who's the breadwinner. You know, we talk about bread as this symbol of so much else all the time that we don't even notice bread itself as a part of that.
Okay, but let's talk about that because bread's a little bit of a cuss word sometimes.
It is.
In our modern culture. I am so glad you wrote about this. I have long given a wary glance at folks who say in any sort of food plant, please don't write me letters about this. And if you're into this, Godspeed. But for me in my life, whenever folks say you should cut out entire groups of foods or one food in particular, you can never, ever eat it, I'm always a little bit wary of that. And I'm supremely wary when folks talk about bread because of what you line up in the book. We have been eating bread from the actual beginning.
Yeah.
But the bread we eat is quite different.
Yes.
In the last 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. So talk to me about that, how bread became this subpar choice. Or, I mean, sometimes folks make it seem like bread is dangerous for us as opposed to really nurturing and nourishing.
Yeah. Yeah. So bread in the United States changed drastically about 100 years ago. So you have kind of two things going on. You have first a deeper understanding of yeast and microbes and the ways that bacteria works. And so suddenly with this understanding of yeast, then there's a fear sort of perpetuated along with it. It's this thing that we can't control that's everywhere. So there's sort of a fear around bacteria and yeast. And then you also have this ability for the industrialization of baking. So baking kind of moved from the domestic sphere into the professional industrialized sphere. And so with this kind of fear of a lack of control, this deep concern with sanitation, then the process of making bread became something that, you know, the industrialized bread became an attempt to sanitize and control the process. So you have these industrialized plants that would advertise the whiteness, the purity, the cleanliness of their loaves. The big thing was, like, these are loaves of bread that have never been touched by a pair of human hands. Therefore, they are, you know, sanitary.
Right. I saw this in my own family. My grandmother was part of that switch. She grew up making, there was always a baking day and she was a master baker and we continued to have her pies and cookies and tarts and all of those things. But she would talk about store-bought, that she used to have to bake bread every week, but now she had store-bought bread. And that to her had been presented as a better option.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's replicable, right? Like when you buy a loaf of bread at the store, it tastes exactly the same. It looks the same. It feels the same every single loaf you buy. when you bake bread at home, it's unpredictable. You have to learn how to kind of respond to it. And you just have to know you're going to get something different every single time you make it. And so there is this sense in which it was offered as like the response to all of the problems, because this was the perfect loaf of bread. But what happened, like to be able to make that sort of replicable loaf, the sort of techniques used to make those loaves degrade the texture of the grain, they degrade the flavor of the grain, and they degrade our ability to digest the grain. So you have what's offered as the ideal bread, and it's actually kind of the opposite of everything that bread has ever been in human history. And now we see kind of this both fear of bread, people physically reacting to bread, and bread has completely changed the role that it's played socially in this last kind of with that shift.
So I don't mean to ask you a question outside of your purview, but I have so many friends who are gluten intolerant, who have to eat a gluten-free diet, their children, they themselves, and they absolutely notice a difference in the way that they digest food. Sometimes I feel like the conversation about gluten-free, it gets into a spot that actually doesn't have to do with how our bodies are doing and more about like, I don't know, a smaller waistline or something like that. But I'm talking about people who actually really have an issue with gluten. Yeah. Do you think that that is a part of this, that the higher incidence of reaction to gluten is because of this?
Okay. Yeah. So I like to differentiate. So celiacs and non-celiac gluten intolerance are kind of two different things that I think need to be talked about differently.
Okay.
So with celiacs, you know, there's plenty of questions of kind of why do we have this rise in autoimmune issues. And I'm not equipped to speak to that at all.
Me either.
But so those who have celiacs, there's just like no, your body, you know, is attacking itself when you consume gluten. And that to me is really heartbreaking. And I have a theological framework that I think is helpful for sort of talking about that. But first I want to talk about the non-celiac gluten intolerance. For many people that do not have celiacs, but their body is still reacting to gluten, largely, they're actually not reacting to the gluten, but they're reacting to a starch inside of the grain that has not been fully, that hasn't been pre-digested, and their body is now struggling to digest. And there's a lot of sort of disagreement as to whether that is because the wheat here in the United States is different. A lot of people will say, like, I go to Europe and I can eat bread and I'm
right.
fine.
Yeah.
And totally. So it's a question of, you know, is it the process that we use to grow our wheat here in the United States? Is it that we have a much slower fermentation? Is it, you know, is it, you know, a variety of things that could be causing this sort of reaction. I think it's probably a combination of them all, but a really long fermentation oftentimes helps most people who cannot have non-celiac gluten intolerance. Oftentimes they're able to eat a bread that has had this really long fermentation because it has broken down that starch their body is reacting to. But one of the things that I really think is fascinating about this, that whether it's kind of lengthening the fermentation, or if it's something to do with the growth and harvesting process of wheat, everything that's changed here in the United States has been to try and speed up the process to get our bread faster. And when we speed up the process at any phase, it becomes something that our bodies struggle to digest well. Our bodies react to this kind of desire to speed up the process. And so in that way, it's just one of many reminders that bread forces us to slow down, that bread requires rest, that bread requires us to kind of not take these shortcuts, or else we don't get as much flavor, but we also get something that works against us.
That'll preach in every area of my life. I am constantly trying to hurry things up and paying the price for that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Not just my bread. That's not the only place. Oh, man. Okay. So to that end, I love that you have talked about long lessons. There are long threads you pull in this. They were not hurried. They weren't in one day you figured out how to blank. And in By Bread Alone, you talk in particular about loneliness and longing and anxiety. And that these are long stretches where you kind of are teasing out, what is God trying to do here and how can I cooperate? You write beautifully about living in the now and the not yet. And you are honest about how some of the things that you have longed for in your personal life have not yet come, particularly marriage and children. And I thought you wrote so tenderly about being single and how it has its own landmines and isolations. And there's this moment where you're with your friend and you're a gunner, James Beard. Okay. So you've got all these plans about what you're doing next. And she kind of gently nudges you to say that one thing that you want is to be a mom. And you at first push back on that, and then find this kind of release and grief when you say that out loud. And so we have listeners who are single and we have listeners who are married and wrangling kids and everybody in all spots here. And I would love for you to talk a little bit to each of those, to both of those groups, the marrieds and the singles, and help us to love each other well in whichever season, because I think you've done some work in that and you can teach us a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of one of the unexpected themes of the book. When I set out to write a book that was a theology of bread, I did not expect this to also become a part of it. But it actually ended up becoming, I think, a really significant part of reflecting on my relationship to food and to community kind of throughout my life. The moment that really shifted things for me, there's that moment that I write about in that particular chapter where I finally realized, like, I'm allowed to grieve and I'm allowed to acknowledge and express sort of my response to this. But then I think the flip side to it happened a couple of years later at the height of the pandemic, when I was living with a roommate who became a really close friend. We were cooking every meal together. And I realized, you know, what I have, like, the deep loneliness that I have been grieving, that I have assumed is like my desire for marriage and family, is actually this desire for companionship and sharing kind of the mundane rhythms of life with someone. And so in a strange way, in this moment, I'm feeling this deep contentedness that I've been sort of desiring and chasing after, and it doesn't look at all like I expected it to look. And so realizing, like, this deeper need that we all share is this need for companionship, this need for community, this need for people that know us deeply and share just the mundane rhythms of our lives. This need for intimacy, not as, you know, sexual intimacy, but as like relational intimacy of people that know us deeply. And that happens in marriage, but it also happens in friendship. And, you know, we experience loneliness whether we are married or not. We experience loneliness whether we have kids or not. That this loneliness and this need for community exists among us all. And that actually we can, you know, find creative ways to build community together that speaks to that need in both those who are single and those who are married, those who have kids, those whose kids have moved out, that all of us experience this need for community and also can be the solution to one another's needs through the differences in our life phases. And so I think for one of the things that was hard and important to me in writing this book was to write about singleness well in a way that did express my experience and that other single people could relate to and feel like they had their own experience validated, but also in a way that helped those who had not experienced long seasons of singleness to understand kind of what that experience is like, because it's really hard to talk about well, and to see it as something other than just kind of complaint, or to see it as something worthy of more than just kind of quick platitudes. And so I wanted it to be something that could help to kind of express that experience for others, but that then also those who have not experienced, you know, long periods of singleness would recognize the ways that they have also experienced loneliness and unmet longing and be able to resonate even if they haven't had the exact same life experience as I have.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I particularly appreciated that you didn't just blow by either side of that coin, right? Either I'm single and I shouldn't feel this longing, right? I should just be, you know, I think particularly in church circles, sometimes the narrative is, well, you know, you should feel complete contentment wherever you are and don't ask, right? And
yeah,
don't,
yeah.
Right?
Well, there's this sense of like, once you're content, God will give this to you.
Right.
So like you need to be content. Like you want it too badly. That's why God's not answering this prayer.
Ooh.
But then once you express true contentment, there's this flip side of like, wait a minute, you can't be too happy in this. Because if you're too happy single, you're not going to try hard enough to find the partner in the family. And either side, you just can't win.
Right. Totally. No, I appreciated that you just gave space for that and that you didn't tie a pretty bow on at the end and say, and so now I have figured everything out. And I just appreciate that because I feel like a lot of times we don't know how to talk about longing and we don't know how to talk about unresolved questions and we don't know how to talk about prayers that aren't done yet. Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Instead of just deciding, okay, well, I guess this is a no. Sometimes it's a wait. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a maybe. And I appreciated mm-hmm. your friend who said, you know, sounds like God has, or I think it was your counselor, sister, mm-hmm. someone.
Sister Chris.
Okay. Sister Chris.
Yes. Now I'm thinking, did I change her name in the book?
I think I called you had to think about
her name is Sister Chris.
The perils of writing a memoir. Right. Oh, I love it. Well, you said that she also acknowledged to you and with you, maybe instead of just stuffing that longing, you can just say, I think maybe God imprinted that.
Yes.
And I don't need to run from it. And also, I don't get to decide on the timing. Like, that is such a tension that I always want to resolve, and we can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think especially when this narrative in the church is like, you just need to be content. It forces us to push past the ways that God can shape us in our longing. It almost like doesn't allow us to long. It wants us to just be happy and not acknowledge what we don't have. But that longing, I think God does shape us in and through our desires, and both the ways God meets those desires and also does not.
So good. And also there we are with bread again, right? Some waiting and some shaping and some responding to what's in the room, not just having a list. And one of the things I love about how you write, Kendall, is it sounds like you like a list. That you are very, I don't know if you can be a baker and not be fairly organized. I mean, you people have kitchen skills. You know what I'm saying?
Oh my goodness. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like every morning you go in the kitchen and you build your list for the day. And I think of it as like time as a game of Tetris where you fill in like what little task can I do at each phase.
Oh, wow.
It's like major organization to do this.
That has to be a gigantic gift. And also, life does not cooperate with lists.
No, not at all.
So do you think that baking has been a part of how you've managed the more unruly parts of your life?
Yes, absolutely. So I always tell people, like, you know, I teach this workshop that I call the Bake and Pray Workshop, and I teach people how to bake bread as a spiritual practice. We talk a lot about rest. We talk about a lot about slowing down, about these spiritual disciplines. And I've had people tell me, like, you know, you must be so, you know, relaxed and peaceful and calm and whatever. And like, I write about this because this is what I have such a hard time with. That like, it is this, none of this comes naturally to me, that bread is so powerful to me because it forces me to sort of counteract my normal tendencies of building lists, of going so fast. And, you know, it's all counterintuitive to me, which is what makes it so good.
Isn't that funny? I feel like a lot of times our best writing comes out of the absolute worst parts, the least natural tendencies for us, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I think, in fact, I've read books by folks that I think this is just like training wheels for them. I don't think it's hard for them. And I usually lose interest because you have to have the grit and the dirt to really help people figure it out. If you haven't gone into the hard places, it's going to be hard to teach. But you do that really well. I knew it. I knew that baking was a part of a coping mechanism. I get it. I totally get it. And this shouldn't surprise us, right? Because you write about this in the book, but what happened in COVID? Everyone bought flour.
Yep.
We were all trying to smell that in our kitchens. We were all trying to remember, okay, if I do this many cups of flour, something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a human tendency. How can I do something that has a beginning, middle, and end and can control that? Don't you think that's part of it?
Totally. I think it's, you know, there's this desire to have a sense of fostering life out of something when we're in this season of so much death. And, you know, I think there's also something about bread that connects us to other people. Even just the fact that everyone was doing it, it felt like this source of connection when we were all so separated. But I also think just tangibly, like when we feel this loss of community and this loss of control, we want something with our bodies to be able to feel like life is still here. You know, something good is still here. I am creating something that I can then consume and share. And
there's something about the sharing. There is something communal about bread. I mean, rarely are you going to sit down and eat a whole loaf at one sitting by yourself.
I will say I have done that before.
I mean, I'm not trying to wrap myself out, but typically I do share. And we've noticed even at our house, and we are lovers of bread. And sometimes I intentionally, when we have folks over, I don't cut. And so everyone's passing around. Yes. This would make all the germs people real nervous, but everybody washes first and then you tear off your own. And I don't know why that like lowers the blood pressure in the room. If it just says, oh no, we're all in this together. Yes. There's something about the sharing that makes it 100% more fun.
So I have been super fascinated. I have recently started really digging into bread traditions in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. Because I really, everything I write about bread, it's like the Orthodox Church has such a rich history in how they talk about bread that I think, you know, Protestants and the Catholic Church just don't have in the same way. And so I have realized like everything I've said has already has a home there. But what I'm finding in so many different places, there are so many different kinds of breads for different holidays that have different traditions around them. And in all of them, there's this statement that you're not ever supposed to let a knife touch bread, that it's always supposed to be torn. And I can't remember exactly what sort of the reasoning is, but kind of all of these different breads, it's like, no, someone needs to tear it. You're not supposed to cut it. So there is kind of a tradition there. We shouldn't cut our bread to tear it because it connects us somehow.
I love that. Well, and even in communion, I'd be very alarmed if my pastor took out a serrated knife and was like, here's the blood
on the altar
for you. A little too tidy.
Yeah.
Hey folks, just a quick interruption here to let you know about another podcast you might enjoy. My friend Bob Goff and I host The Writing Room, a place where authors talk shop. Whether you are a writer yourself, or you're just curious about how in the world an idea ends up with a barcode, The Writing Room is a place where we talk about all things books. Neither Bob nor I are really into secrets, so we pull back the curtain on how we go about writing and how to have some fun along the way. We would love for you to join us on the adventure. The Writing Room is available on all your favorite streaming platforms and airs nationally on K-Love Radio. And now, back to the conversation.
Okay, now I'm going to hit you with a bunch of very specific bakery questions.
Love it.
Okay. I want to try every single recipe in your book. So that's the first thing. And if you ever decide to write an entire cookbook, I am buying it immediately. So you have one buyer right here.
Perfect.
For sure.
Okay. Perfect. I can tell you that one will be coming.
Oh, yes.
I am not just doing this research on Eastern Orthodox baking traditions for no reason.
Yes,
it's already contracted. It's due a month ago.
It's due
not done.
Okay.
Not done, but it was
so
due a month ago.
About a year from now, I would guess. For
year and a half-ish, yeah.
Oh, I'm so ready. Get me on the list, sister. Okay. So these are maybe you will already address these very technical questions, but talk to me about flour. Okay. I know you pastry people go a little buck wild. I wrote a book one time called Sugar. It's a novel. The main character is a pastry chef. So for my research, I read many technical manuals directed to you with just like more detail than you'll ever want to know in your whole life, and cookbooks of very fancy pastry chefs. And I shadowed someone, like I did a lot of what you do in your life normally. I had to learn, and then I don't know how, but I know there are feelings about flour. But for the average home baker, do you have a particular kind or brand of flour? If someone's listening thinking, man, I haven't baked bread in a long time or ever, where do we start?
So I'm a huge fan of King Arthur flours.
Okay. Me too.
Yes. So especially when you're talking about bread baking has so many different variables that affect the final loaf. So the temperature, the humidity, kind of all of these things impact the way that your loaf will turn out. And so when I am teaching bread baking, I want to make it as unintimidating as possible. I want someone to feel like they can just work it into the rhythms of their life. And so the best way to do that is to limit those variables as much as you can. And so King Arthur is a really high quality, but really consistent brand. So every kind of bag is going to behave similarly. Whereas I love getting flour from my local farmers, but every bag is going to behave differently.
A little differently.
Okay. So it just takes a lot more sort of technical understanding. So I'm a big fan of learning with King Arthur. It's great stuff. They're
fantastic.
A really great company. Yeah.
Great. And I can go to my grocery store and get it. That's what
you
I'm talking about.
You
it's
can.
Accessible. Okay.
Yes. I'm also a huge fan of sprouted grain flours. They're super fun to work with. Sprouted wheat is the most commonly available, but I love sprouted spelt. And so some grocery stores are starting to carry them. King Arthur does have a sprouted wheat flour. Whole Foods carries a few more varieties, but the miller that I get them from is called Lindley Mills. It's here in North Carolina, but they ship nationwide. So if you go on their website, you can order their sprouted spelt, sprouted rye, sprouted wheat. If you want to sort of mix things up a bit, that's a really, really great way to start.
Okay, fantastic. We'll link to all of this. Number two, butter. Do we need to be fussy about our butter? Let's talk about,
So
European, what do I need?
For the butter that I bake with, I just buy the cheapest unsalted butter I can get at the store. I am fine with that for baking. Okay. The butter that I smear on top of my bread, I love to get the good stuff.
Okay.
So I buy Plougra butter, which is a European style cultured butter. It's a higher fat content cultured butter. It has so much flavor. It's so good. So Plougra? I spread that in a little bit of salt. Plougra, P-L-U-G-R-A. Okay. Some grocery stores carry it. I get it at the restaurant supply store, which is
where
I buy all my ingredients. But I do think some grocery stores get that. But so the cultured butters have so much flavor to them. Yes. The European style means it's higher fat content, which just means more flavor.
Europeans, they always know how to do things with more flavor.
Right. But Kerrygold butter is also a great one to go on top. So much flavor there too.
Okay, great. These are great recommendations. Last one. What about our GF friends? So, and tips for me as I bake for my GF friends.
Yeah. So when it comes to bread baking, it is an entirely different craft to do gluten-free bread baking versus, you know, glutinous bread baking. And I always say that's just not my skill set. And I am such a firm believer in good bread that I believe everyone deserves to have good bread. And if you're gluten-free, you deserve to have it from someone who knows how to make good gluten-free bread, and I'm not that person. Okay. So there is a food blogger and cookbook writer who is gluten-free who has developed, I think, a technique for a really great crusty gluten-free bread. Her site is called Quenelle et Vanille. And I don't remember what her books are called, but she's got one, and I think she's got an online course that's all kind of crusty sourdough gluten-free bread. So that's where I would turn.
Great recommendation. We will link to that as well. And one last thought before we head out, and I have a couple final questions for you. You mentioned you teach as well, that you have online courses, correct? So tell us how to find you. And is that under the paradigm of Edible Theology, your nonprofit?
Yeah. So I used to teach a lot of virtual bread baking workshops during the pandemic. Now I do less of them that are open to the public and more I will connect with churches or schools or organizations that want to host them. So I do have one on the Wednesday of Holy Week, April 5th, I think, is when I will be teaching one. And there is a link on the Edible Theology website. So it's a 2-hour workshop. But apart from that, if you want me to come teach at your church or at your school or to teach, I teach them over Zoom sometimes. So you can reach out to me through the Edible Theology website or my personal website and arrange that too. It's super fun. It's a 2-hour workshop. We learn how to bake bread. You mix up the bread yourself. But we also talk about the spiritual parallels through it and also think how to bake bread as a spiritual practice, as kind of a form of prayer of meeting God in this process of baking.
I love it. And you have a sampling of that in your book, kind of walking through baking and kind of a prayer, almost it's a liturgy as you are baking, inviting God into that process and having your heart change, not just while you're waiting and looking at the clock. It's just very, very beautifully done. So I'm signing up. Okay. Last thing. I love this theme in your book of enoughness. You have spent some time, and I have certainly spent some serious time, assuming that the small, quiet, humble pursuits of my life were just the on-ramp to the actual important stuff. So for you, that forming loaf after loaf of bread wasn't a big enough calling for your life, right? That you were kind of waiting for the thing. And I'm learning, and it seems like you have too, that the small things are the thing and that they're more than enough. And I want to read a few words of yours to you, and I hope that doesn't freak you out. It entirely freaks me out when people do this, but this is what you write. It's tempting to look for God at work in big, spectacular ways, to assume that God's movement involves wild answers to prayer, but often God's movement is more subtle. Through the people around us and through the bread we share, God whispers to us, I love you. I'm with you. I care. I am so grateful for your words and so grateful for how you are living that and teaching this to us. So thank you for writing those, and thank you for writing just a beautiful book.
Well, thank you so much. It was truly a gift to be able to write this. I think writing it was healing to me in many ways. And it's just a joy to think that, you know, for me, this process was healing and that feels like enough. And now to think that like, oh man, other people might also, you know, be able to see God in a new way through this too is really a gift.
Yes. I love it. There are many people I was thinking of as I was keeping a list on the side, who to buy this book for. And it's getting longer and longer.
I love that.
Okay. Last question. Speaking of books, we always ask our guests two particular questions. All about books. And I see 8,000 books behind you. And so I feel like this is safe. So it's a two-parter. First, what is a book that you recommend over and over to people? It can be super old. It can be something that came out a million years ago or a new one, but one that you find yourself returning to. And it could be a cookbook, by the way, because of you.
Well, this one is, oh, sorry.
Yeah, Should I go ahead and then we'll do part B.
This one is another sort of, it's not really a cookbook, but it is a cookbook. Okay. It's a book called The Supper of the Lamb by Robert Farrar Capon. Have you heard of this one before?
Well, you mention it in your book.
I do. You're right. It's brilliant. So it's about 60 years old at this point, but still just, it's so fun, so brilliant. Father Capon was an Episcopal priest, but he was also a food writer for the New York Times. How about that duo? So great. Wow. Clearly, we would have been friends if we had overlapped at any point. But so he and his wife also wrote a satirical column for a satirical Christian newspaper called the Wittenberg Door. And so Supper of the Lamb is kind of the confluence of all three. It's rich theologically. It is absolutely hilarious. And it's all about food and this idea of kind of the Supper of the Lamb as kind of this, the marriage supper of the Lamb imagery from the book of Revelation, but also he is developing literally a supper of lamb, like lamb cooked four ways or something.
Wow. So
it's brilliant. It's so fun.
I love it. I had never heard of that before you, and now I have to buy it. Okay, yes. Great recommendation, Supper of the Lamb. And now my part B, something you're excited to tuck into, a book on your book stand or something someone has recommended to you that you think, oh my gosh, as soon as I have the time, this is it.
Yes. Well, so I am just eager to tuck into Beth Moore's new memoir.
Same.
So excited. I have it on its way. But another I'm really excited about is David Taylor's new book, Body of Praise.
Okay.
So he's a theologian. It's a book on sort of a theology of the body, but also of worship through the body. I am very excited for that one.
Oh, two great recommendations. Beth Moore had very kind things to say about your book, miss. So that's pretty good. She gets asked a lot.
Yes, she does. Well, I did send it to her with a loaf of bread. So I had some good, incentive there.
This is called super smart marketing. Okay. Never apologize for that. Right. I got nothing to send. So that's great. I can borrow one of your loaves and send it along. I think it's great. And she's spot on. It's a fantastic book. Kendall Vanderslice, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for writing about good, beautiful, delicious things.
Oh, thank you so much.
I will tell you that the day we recorded this episode was also the day that I turned off my mic and went straight to the grocery store to buy two kinds of flour for my new bread baking ambition. I'm super excited to try the recipes in Kendall's book, and I'm also super excited to eat the results of trying those recipes. I will report back. In the meantime, follow Kendall on the socials and let her know how grateful you are that she joined us today. Thank you so much for being here with me. I hope your brain and your heart and probably your stomach too all feel like they have been nourished today. Please remember to share this episode, rate the pod, and don't forget to open wide the doors to your own table after hearing all the good stuff that Kendall had to share. And come back soon. We have a spot saved just for you. For real.